Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. You know, I love talking to authors because they have the courage to take their thoughts, stories, and lessons and share it with the many, ultimately changing their legacy and destiny in the process. And if you're looking to write a book out there, check out dreamstarterspublishing.com. We can help you out with wherever you're at in the process. And if you already have a book and you want to put on autopilot to generate leads for your business, check out bookmarketingcrm.com. The book that we're talking about today is in regards to raising capital, raising funds for your dream project, or potentially for something that you're putting together in regards to helping others create wealth and freedom. And so stay tuned for this if you want to start learning some tips and tricks from an individual who wrote a book called How to Raise a Venture Capital Fund, The Essential Guide on Fundraising and Understanding Limited Partners. The author is with us today, Winter Mead. Thanks so much for being here, sir.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with the genesis of this book, man. What made you want to write it? I'm assuming you have an extensive background in this area. So if you can give us a quick little rundown on where you come from and how you got to where you're at now, I think that'd be helpful too.
Yep, happy to. So my background is in financial services. I was working for a multifamily office, which you can think of that as like a bunch of wealthy people that are looking for wealth managers that are managing their wealth on their behalf. I was on the private equity team, which means I was investing into companies that are still private and people that are buying kind of equity in those companies that are still private. But you know, part of private equity is venture capital, right? So the book is called How to Raise a Venture Capital Fund. You know, for the listeners, like, it can be broader than just venture capital. It could be how to raise a private equity fund, or just generally like how to raise a fund. But it comes at it from the institutional limited partners lens. So limited partners are the money behind the money. They are the people that, again, like these high net worth individuals or corporations or endowments or foundations or pension funds that finance these, you know, private markets, these private market opportunities and investments. And the way they mainly do that is through a diversified vehicle called fund, right? So most funds are not a single asset. They're a diversified pool of multiple assets, right? So a venture capital fund doesn't just own one company, it owns shares of 50 companies, for example, right? So when we're talking about how to raise a venture capital fund, we're kind of talking about that part of the market, which is this fund. Someone's a fund manager. They, you know, make the decisions and put the investments into the fund. But there's a lot of things that, you know, go into that, like we can get into in the next few minutes. But, you know, what I noticed, to answer your question, why did I write the book? There's just a gap in the market, right? There's some other books that were written about how do technology companies work? How should you scale technology companies? Even how you should be a CEO of a technology company. But there wasn't really a book on how to kind of, you know, do the other side of the table, which is the venture capitalist side of the table. And how do you become a better venture capitalist? How do you raise money as a venture capitalist? How do you raise a fund? And so it felt like a missing part of the literature. And, you know, I guess I put some pen to paper and out came the book.
Yeah. And just so, you know, the average person listening understands, you're talking about limited partners. There's a thing called general partners also, right? So general partners are more on the active role, and then limited partners are really investing for passive income or passive net worth gain. Am I right?
Yeah. So a venture capital fund could have, you know, as many as 2,500 limited partners. I'd say most have less than 100. You could also have a single limited partner into a fund. And then, yeah, you have the general partner. The general partner is the person making the decisions. They're running the business. Think of the general partner as like the founder or the entrepreneur starting the business. And that business happens to be a fund business.
Got it. Yeah. So I've been in the world with other real estate individuals, whether it's multifamily, self-storage, and there are general partners and limited partners. And I've always pursued the role of a limited partner because I don't want to do anything except have my money work for me. But the general partners are more so the experts in that area. And they have the connections and they're the ones solving the problems. Am I right?
Correct.
Yeah. Yep. So looking at your book here, I just want to kind of jump to chapter 2, and it talks about designing your fund's investment strategy, maybe almost reverse engineering the why of what you're going to do and what you want to accomplish, and maybe dissecting how you will make your money. So putting this all together, I mean, I think all of this can transcend just venture capital funds, but let's break that down into maybe understanding the pathway of where you're going and maybe why.
Oh boy. Let me on page 17, let me try to remember. I just like pick up the copy right here and look, but the strategy piece, right? I think there's a few concepts when you start talking about funds that I think get confused or conflated. So one of those is like, what is your strategy? And like, that could be a real estate strategy, for example, right? Like, I'm just buying commercial properties. I'm going to buy 10 commercial properties. They're all going to sit, you know, I'm going to own pieces of each of those different 10 properties. And then like, they're all going to sit into a fund, right? So it rolls up to a fund. You got 10 commercial properties. In venture capital, right? Like, the strategy is big picture. You're going to buy equity into fast growing, usually technology companies. And like I said, you're going to like buy 10 to 50 of those, and that's going to roll up into the fund. So your fund's going to own, you know, positions in 10 to 50 different companies. And what you're hoping in venture capital is one of those is going to turn into the next Stripe or OpenAI or Uber or Microsoft or Facebook or something along those lines. And then that's kind of where you generate your wealth, right? Okay. So you're trying to do as much work as possible to like figure out, you know, which companies early on are doing great things. And that's kind of like, that kind of leads to the strategy, right? So I think the strategy is similar across different venture funds, right? It's like, pick the best companies and get access into the best companies. But I think a fund strategy can be a little bit more nuanced than that. And that's kind of like what creates your right to win. Because like venture, there's a lot of, it's a very much like a relationship game. Like, you need to have the relationships, you need to maintain the relationships, you need to have relationships over time. Like, you need to kind of be in the business of, you know, creating domain expertise and creating a right to win at the fund level. It's not just finding, you know, one of millions of commercial properties. It's like, usually there's these very specialized technical teams that you're trying to win access into. And so when you think about the strategy, like, the strategy before you even raise the fund comes from like your experience of like, what have you done? Like, have you built businesses in the past that are very similar? Have you helped scale like some of the most winning products in the past? Like, have you been in a VC and like, you've already invested into 50 or 100 companies before you get to my book, right? Before you get to the point of like defining your own fund strategy. But your fund strategy is largely built on your experience as an investor or as an operator. And so I think, again, similar to if you're making a bet on someone that's running a real estate fund, like, you probably don't want to bet on that person if this is their first commercial property that they're buying, right? So they probably have some reps of maybe building commercial properties or investing into commercial properties or managing commercial properties. And they build up a skill set, right, that gives them a right to win and gives them a perspective on like which commercial properties are good to invest into and which are not good. And so in venture capital, it's very similar. Like, you're building this skill set. Usually it's a technical skill set. You're building this operating skill set. You're building this investment acumen, right? And you're generating a thesis, which is one of these terms that can get conflated, like the difference between a thesis and a strategy. Like, the thesis is kind of your insight into the market of, oh, you know what? Generative AI companies are the only type of company we should be investing in because of XYZ. Or, you know, actually everyone's got it wrong. They're investing into generative AI companies. You should actually be investing into this part of AI that no one else is thinking about, right? Because of XYZ, right? It's like this insight into the market you have. When you, that takes time and experience, but when you have that insight, then usually like that's one of the building blocks of raising a fund. And then you start thinking about, okay, I've got this insight in the market. I've got this experience. Like, it's all starting to come together. Now I need to like, you know, put my fund together and build a strategy to create this repetitive process of winning access into 50 companies, right? Because again, like, you're not just doing a single asset when you raise a venture capital fund. You've got to consistently source, consistently diligence, and consistently win access into, you know, let's call it 50 companies or more.
How specific or how niche do these venture capitalist funds get? So
they can get pretty niche.
Yeah. So it could just be credit card processing, right? It could just be data. It could also just be transportation like Uber, right? Are you saying it could be so selective? Therefore, it's, I mean, maybe you kind of, you know, all the players, right, in these worlds. So you pretty much can see the landscape at a pretty easy to see perspective. Am I right?
Yeah. So I think, there's a couple of points there. So when people think of venture, they usually think of like 10 or 20 of the top firms, right? I met with 1,010 firms last year. Wow. So like when people think of venture, they think like, oh, just like the top brand names, like the household names. And again, like those are very good investors. They've raised lots of capital. They have lots of assets under management. They're writing very big checks. They're very smart people. They're, you know, with their brand and with their expertise, winning allocations, some of the best tech companies, right? So that's kind of like one strategy. But again, like there's this whole other world of smaller funds and smaller managers. And that world, like they can get very niche. Like to your point, like, yes, a VC fund built on basically data collected from credit card processing. Or it can be like a fund that specializes in, you know, regulation, like some of these companies that are building, you know, what some call deep technology, right? Like they are going to run in regulated industries. Maybe that's even like healthcare, but it's like a venture fund that just focuses on like policy for a specific industry, or mobility to your point, or like voice, right? Like, hey, there's like, you know, voice companies, right? That's a very specialized fund. Or it can be geography. Like I'm just investing into companies in, you know, Nashville or Bentonville or, you know, Boise, Idaho or something like that. So you can get pretty niche when it comes to venture funds. Now, how many people want to invest into a venture fund that just does deals in Boise, Idaho? Probably some, but is everyone going to want to do that? Maybe not, right? So you're kind of limiting your prospects from the LP side. But again, there's a dichotomy here where if you're too generalist and you're just saying like, hey, what are you going to invest into? Everything. Like I'm open to everything, right? Then no one's going to know what you stand for.
Yeah, that's a mutual fund.
No one knows what you stand for. And so you have to balance it. Like you have to stand for something as a new investor, like a new fund manager. And that's why you have to like strike that right balance where you got to be specialized enough where people are like, oh yeah, like that's interesting. Like that is an insight. Like I do want to like buy that. And you also like can't be, you know, too specialized to the point where someone's like, I'm looking for some diversification in my general portfolio. Like you're not offering me that by, you know, investing into this super specialized part of the market.
Yeah. I would assume that you see many funds in regards to maybe some type of medical care, you know, right? New technology coming out. And so the people who are, whether they're the ones running or whatever, have some type of medical background. Therefore, they can understand a little bit more than the average person. And so I am not a part of this world. This is so fascinating to me. And my assumption is that there are numbers that show that one out of 50, like you say, is what they're looking for. They're looking for one to be the home run. So do you have any data or any statistics that can blow us out of the water right here on this call? Not to put you on the spot at all.
I mean, just generally, like none fully memorized, but I mean, the kind of general heuristics are if you're building out a portfolio, like a third, a third, a third is like a common heuristic. So a third of your portfolio is going to generate most of the return. A third is going to kind of be like, you know, it might generate kind of like a 1x in total for your fund. So if your fund's like 50 million, like maybe that like a third of those 50 companies will generate kind of 50 million in return. And then a third will just be write-offs. Other people though are, again, like, there's no like super hard data on this. Other people will say, 90% of your companies, 9 out of 10 companies are going to be like write-offs, right? So again, like it's, when you refer to venture capital specifically, it's different than private equity. It's different than real estate. Like the expectation is most companies will fail. It's like playing baseball. Like you get into the Hall of Fame if you, you know, bat 300 or bat 400, like bat 300, basically. Not a lot of people bat 400, but you know, it's kind of like a similar concept where 3 out of 10 makes you a hero. Like in venture, it's very similar. Where again, so what you're looking for, again, like this is venture specific, but what you're looking for is a special type of company, right? Like it's a high growth company. It's not a company that's going to grow kind of 20% year over year. It's a company that's going to grow potentially hundreds of percent year over year in the beginning, right? And so you can scale up to a lot of value. And that value, you know, is going to kind of be able to, you know, that company is going to be able to be realized, sold, or, you know, listed in a 10 to 12 year period and return back capital that covers like most of your investments. And again, like if you have a couple of wins per portfolio, like you're generating, you know, if you have two to three of those winners in a portfolio, you're generating like, you know, a 3 to 5X. I'd say, you know, you're looking for other numbers are, you know, I'd say one out of every, you know, there's some data that came out like 10 years ago that did kind of a longitudinal study. Like for one of those like unicorn companies, like 1 to 2% of every company's like, again, like this is assuming you're on the in crowd, you're like exceptional, like you have all the relationships, you have it super dialed in, like 1 to 2% are going to be like very big outcomes. And that's assuming you're already like on the, you know, inmost in a circle of like inner circle of like VC. So again, it's like a very hits driven business and it's a very relationship driven business, which makes it like very tough. There are other models though now that are kind of like expanding this out, right? Like there's the folks that are looking like smaller funds have an advantage because like they can afford to sell their company for $50 or $100 million and actually return a significant part of their fund and sometimes even multiples of their fund. So if they get in early enough, they have the right amount of ownership and that company sells for, you know, $100 or $200 million, they don't need like a $10 billion exit to return all of their money. Like, so there's definitely, I'd say, a divide with how people think about their, you know, portfolio construction, where some people are like, hey, I want to be a small fund, deliberately have good ownership in these companies and still buy into this high growth business. And there's, you know, there's option value, there's exit value, like and options at the exit for you if you kind of take that strategy versus if you raise a much bigger fund, which, you know, takes a long time to do. But if you have a $1 billion fund, that's a lot of market capitalization you have to create in order to like return multiples of that fund. And so just assuming for like a case study, you know, you own 10% of the business and you're a $1 billion fund, right? For you to return 1X, for you to return that $1 billion to your investors, you have to generate $10 billion worth of market capitalization because you own 10% of the business, right? So 10% of 10 billion is a billion back. If you want to generate a 3X on that, right? You still own 10%, you have to generate $30 billion of market capitalization, right? So it's definitely like a big boys game. Like when you start to talk about these big funds, like you have to play the hits business. Like you can't miss stuff. Like you have to take kind of those shots on goal and take those option bets into your portfolio because like the math is you have to get a 3X on $1 billion, like generate $30 billion worth of market capitalization. But again, like, again, let's play that back. Now, if you're a $10 million fund and let's say, you know, it's much harder to own 10% of the business, but you get in early enough, right? And let's say you own 5% of the business, right? And then you have, you know, $100 million exit, right? Let's say a $200 million exit for simple math, you own 5% of the business, you've paid back your fund, right? So instead of needing $10 billion of market capitalization, you need one company to kind of take off and be plucked by a big corporate for $200 million, you've returned your fund, right? And if you want a 3X, you need $600 million of market capitalization. So again, smaller funds have an advantage. They're still playing venture. They're still trying to get in these high growth assets, but it's just like a different game when you're kind of playing in the small fund world versus playing in the big fund world.
I'm looking at your bio here on Amazon. I don't know how up to date it is, but I'm looking at how much you were, I guess you could say, it seems Wintermead has worked in financial services for a decade at two SEC registered investment firms that has invested approximately $1 billion across 80 private equity and venture capital firms as limited partners. So can you give us some like numbers that, you know, will allow you to show off a little bit of what you've done? And maybe like you said, it's a big boys game. So I'm assuming you've been with some really big firms or people, and just seeing how the wealthy operate, maybe how decisive or maybe indecisive or emotional or lack of emotion, or maybe how they just operate their business. Any insight would be very beneficial.
Yeah. my style is not showing off, but I'll try to kind of give some insight into what played out at different institutional shops. So a couple of things. So, you know, working at two institutional shops, right? A lot of it comes down to thinking about, like, let's say, okay, you've raised the fund. Now what? Right. And like at the firms I worked for, right, like the funds were raised. And so now we're kind of getting into like, how do you invest? Like, deploy, how do you think about actually deploying that capital? Like once you've raised the fund, a lot of it comes down to like a few things. One, thinking about setting up the operations, because like what LPs expect of you is for you to have created a repeatable process.
Got it.
Right. Like, again, like if you got to do 50 deals, like you don't want to kind of like invest in the first 50 things that cross your desk, right? Like even the best of the best, like what they try to do is they try to build a machine of deal sourcing, right? And that you can do that in different ways. You can hire junior people to do that. Now you can use like AI to help with that, right? Or, you know, you might have, again, been like very skilled and specialized, and like you just know all the people in the industry and you're like proactively kind of like sourcing deals. Like there's different ways to get to that top of funnel. But like sourcing is a big part, and like you want to see as much as possible, and you want to create a process of diligence, right? An investment process that's very focused, almost formulaic, right? Because then you're being a true fiduciary of capital. Like that money that you've raised for the fund, most of it's not your money. You're probably gonna have a GP commitment. Like you're gonna commit some dollars alongside of your LPs. But 98, 99% of that, it can, at least in venture capital, is not going to be your money. So like you have to create a process that is almost a risk management process for deploying that capital.
Got it. Right? And I would assume you get some type of, is it not an assignment fee, but it's a management fee. That's all it is, right? Something like that.
There's a management fee that kind of, keeps the lights on, pays for office space, pays for your salary, pays for the salaries of like other people that you've brought onto the firm. But the point is like, you're using that management fee to generate the value, right? And like build this system, build this machine that I'm referring to. And so that is both like on the op side, right? Like you got to manage all the data. You've got to like make sure kind of you can source through that data, like parse through that data and like get to good decisions, like with that data, like ideally data-driven decisions. But that's a process. That's an investment process. And I think most fund managers, like if we're talking about like mistakes that maybe fund managers make, I don't think they think about building that investment process enough, right? And it's like, what does that do? That's effectively like investment, like a investment process is effectively like a risk management process of you being able to run a process to identify risks in your investments. So again, like I think a lot of people think of venture capital and they think of like, you know, people kind of running around buying a bunch of lottery tickets, like the numbers I kind of alluded to even earlier, right? Where there's such a small percentage of wins, right? That's not because kind of you're just like guessing on what's great. You're doing an immense amount of diligence on what's good. And then it's very difficult to build a business, to build any business, right? Especially like a high growth business that has to scale and to be hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in value, right? So you're building this really tight, focused investment process to help inform your decision-making process so you make better decisions. But those are, you know, risk adjusted decisions. That's a risk management process where you're kind of saying like, hey, I've got 10 check boxes that are all risks that could be identified as early as possible, or they're all potential opportunities too. If I, you know, run my process and I identify, you know, whether or not like the company has this checkbox or doesn't, you're kind of like, and again, you can be early stage, you can be late stage, but like you're kind of running your process over and over and over again to the same process, where is why like there's like a common phrase where, you know, right process, wrong outcome, right? Like if you look back at it and you audited your decision-making process, you could say like, hey, actually I'd make that decision again, right? And for whatever reason, like the company just didn't work out. So I think what you're trying to do, like the deployment for me is like, you're like the name of the game is trying to build a machine, like a deployment process. That's an investment process. That's a decision-making process that gets you to risk-adjusted decisions that are very strong over and over and over and over again. Like that's the machine that you've built on the decision-making side. And if you don't do that, you're doing yourself a disservice because you're kind of more gambling than actually you know, making informed decisions, you know, like, again, a lot of these decisions aren't going to play out. You're not going to have the right outcome, but like you have to try for every company you underwrite in a venture firm to try to think through like, okay, if all the ducks aligned, actually this would return the fund and even more so than that. Right. So that's the name of the game for venture. Like you're looking for a very special type of company and then you bet on that company. And again, like it's so early, you don't know if it's actually going to win. And most of the time it's not going to, but when it does, because you've built this great investment process, that's when you start to like reap the benefits of the venture model.
And you said the magic word repeatable, right? It's not that they want to play with you for one deal or one fund and then that's it. This is long-term wealth. They're playing this game for the long run. Am I right? So the way they're looking at it is, all right, I'm in it for the long run, but once we cash out, I want to deploy it right away, right? So they're looking for certain things. And I would assume that, you know, in this upper echelon world, maybe they all have something in mind of how they're going to just have their capital, keep producing more capital. And I don't know if there's anything you could share in regards to that, but are they looking for just, or, you know, 1 to 5 years? Are they looking longer, generational wealth? What have you seen?
Yeah, I think the venture model, the way it's kind of built at the fund level is 10 plus two. Now, if you go to different countries, there's an international audience on the line. Like sometimes that can be less. There's also structures called evergreen structures. And so you have like a 20-year fund or, you know, a fund that can exist kind of forever. And there's, you know, certain periods of time when you can buy in or sell out. But the traditional kind of venture model, fund model in the US is 10 plus two, meaning like you have 10 years to kind of invest, manage, and harvest your portfolio. And then an additional, usually 2 years at your discretion as the GP to extend that harvest period.
That's helpful.
So all funds are trying to like do this whole model in 12 years. So that's another factor that plays into a lot of times into your decision-making process where you're saying like, hey, and that's why it's like, is this company growing fast enough? Because if you compound at 10%, right? Like that could be interesting. That could be an interesting part of your portfolio if part of your personal portfolio or personal wealth is compounding at 10% per year, right? But in venture, you're trying to compound a lot higher than that, right? And if you play that compounding out 10 years, right? Like then you actually start to get the 3x multiples or the 5x multiples, but you're trying to fit it in and compress it into that time frame.
So what type of position do they usually take? And this probably differs, but on average, are they looking for 10%, 20%, 30%? The reason why I ask is because when I look at, and this is obviously a different setup, but the BlackRocks, Vanguard, State Streets, they have pretty much a majority ownership in, I think, 80% of the S&P 500. So are you looking for whether it's a large stake in certain companies? And my next question is, how much are they looking at the management, the people running those companies? And the reason why I ask is because I've been reading about the PayPal mafia when it first started. It was like 12 people. If you look at all 12 people, they all went on to do amazing things in the world. And so I'm thinking they built the relationships and they had the trust, therefore they could acquire the funds for their next projects, which all went really well. So I know that's a lot thrown at you with everything that you know. So can you answer both those questions?
Yeah. I heard kind of three things there. One way to think about kind of ownership percentage over time, like just simplifying it for the audience, like think of it in maybe like three or four buckets. You've got like basically that inception stage of when you're investing in a company initially. You've got the early stage, you've got the growth stage, and maybe you've got the pre-IPO stage, right? Because everything we're talking about is happening in the private markets. And then, you know, pre-IPO, like the next stage is like public IPO, right? Like the public markets, what you just alluded to. But in those four stages in the private markets, and again, there's a lot more nuance to that, but when you're initially investing like a small fund, like at the pre-seed, like the early, like very early stage, inception stage, it's probably trying to own like the company's probably selling like 5 to 10% of it itself, like maybe up to like 20%. And then at the early stage, right, like there's a lot of like brand name firms that kind of focus on this stage because then the business has some proof points. You've seen the management team execute. You've seen the product being built. You've seen that product kind of exist in the market. Like, is someone buying it? Is someone not buying it? And if they are, right, and it's, you know, then you can get some more insight into, okay, this company might actually be growing like pretty fast. Then at that stage, like, again, that consortium of investors buys, you know, 20 to 30% of the company. So you can, you know, at that stage have sold like 40, 50% of your company. And then, you know, it starts to like, if you actually hit that inflection point, you start scaling really quickly, kind of you have like a number of different growth rounds, but you're buying kind of less percent, like the company's getting more valuable. You're bringing more capital to the table, but because the company's more valuable, you're selling shares at a higher price, right? So you're not selling shares at a $10 million price, you're selling shares at a $100 million price, right? So if you spend $1 million at a $10 million post in the beginning, you've bought 10% of the company. But if you spent $1 million at a $100 million post a little bit later on, you bought 1% of the company, right? So, right, you're as a founder, like you're developing this traction as a company and your company's becoming more valuable. And like investors are buying into that company as it's becoming more valuable. So you're going down over time. But at the end of the game, like, yeah, as a founder, like you might only own 20%, maybe less of the company. Like if, you know, probably less if like you're exiting later on and you've raised like a ton of different rounds to kind of get to, you know, a big pie, like a big company. Management is really key, right? Especially in the beginning where there's not a lot of product and there's not a lot of numbers, like revenues, operating metrics.
Yeah, that's what I would assume.
It's almost the thing, right? Like, again, like it's a VC bet, like you're betting on a certain type of high growth company. So there's definitely like that bet on like the market, but team's also really, really big. It's like, can this team actually execute on this strategy that they've kind of painted a vision for? And a lot of early stage VCs are trying, again, like that's where the relationship aspect, like what I alluded to, comes in. It's like, you've built these relationships with these founders and they're kind of coming to you like thinking critically about a specific market or how to solve a specific problem. And they developed a specific solution and they're kind of like, again, painting a vision of like, hey, here's how the world can change. Here's how we can build this product. Here's how this product can be amazing and like impact the lives of millions, or it can like, you know, be super, super huge in terms of a market. I think that's the management team. Like that's a special type of person that solves those type of problems, can manage kind of a high growth environment, building a business in like a super high growth environment. Like this isn't really a lifestyle business, like if you choose the VC route. And so, you know, VCs are trying to sort for like those people that are willing to, you know, put themselves into the 15, 20 hour days for 5 straight years. Like, right. Like that's kind of what it takes to kind of build a real business, like venture scale business. So management is like very important, but it's also like a different type of skill set. It's not the management team you're looking for in a public company, right? Like, or even the management team you're looking for in like a pre-IPO company. Like this is a management team that's like very product focused, very visionary, like very good at kind of building teams and recruiting talent. Like you're going, you know, from one person or two people to 10 people to 100 people. Like that's a special skill set.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And you're not just like coming in and kind of managing a multi-thousand person organization. Right. So it's a very different skill set, a very different type of person kind of you're looking for. So like IP, like public companies or private companies, you're both looking for management, but you're looking for like as a private investor, like an early stage VC investor, something like a little bit different about the management team, right? So you're looking for different attributes. And then I think, yeah, to your point, like, you know, success begets success. So like, you know, if you're successful at picking management teams, you've created that repeatable process, you know, and, you know, you've had some wins under your belt. Like, I think that's how brands are built and that's how, you know, legacy is built. Into the PayPal mafia comment, right? Like success begets success and you still have to deliver, right? It's not like it gets easier, right? It might actually get harder and like might actually have more stuff to do. But at that point, like, right, like, yeah, the capital markets is more in your favor. So some stuff gets maybe a little bit easier on the capital market side, but not necessarily easier on the execution side.
You touched on a good point there. And I've seen it to go from a $10,000 business to $100,000 to $1 million to now 8 figures. We've transformed, you know, we're on our way to 8 figures. We've transformed so much. Now that's peanuts when it comes to some of these big companies, whether it's Stripe or Meta or whatever. So when you've probably seen these companies evolve, right? And this transformation that happens. And I have realized that, you know, what gets you here is probably what's going to keep you here. So you're always changing. And I would assume many management teams change as time goes on. You look at Apple with all that transformation and who had to go and who had to stay. And it's wild to see it. And I guarantee you notice it because you're in that world and you're paying attention to the numbers. And is this a common thing? Number one, are you noticing that all the time. The transformation in the company, management roles are adjusting, and it's never ending. And then there's, I'll stop with there for now. I have one more question. So have you noticed?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's a bias towards like keeping the original founder around. So like if you're a VC, you've raised a fund, you know, you're kind of going through that investment process I alluded to, and you're picking a team, like I think you're trying to pick someone that you think can stick around and grow with the business. So maybe one of the attributes you're looking for is like, how coachable is this person? Mm-hmm. Like, and do I think they can grow up over time? Cause again, like they're going to be growing up over 5 to 10 years of that period of time, like when you're invested in the company. I think it's less like, oh, I'm going to invest in this person now, and like, I'm hoping to like change them out in 2 to 3 years. So I think that I'd say that's probably the consensus. I think from my perspective, maybe people would argue with me on that point. But I think like when you're a VC making an early stage decision, you're looking for someone that, again, like they're coachable, they can attract talent. And then like, you know, that old phrase where like, you're trying to hire people that are better than you. Like that is, I think you're looking for someone that has excellent market acumen, product acumen, they're visionary, right? Like they can inspire people. You're trying to get that person, like picking that person. You're like, hey, you have an insight that no one else has, and maybe an expertise that no one else has. And, you know, you're so inspiring that everyone's going to come work for you. Right. And like, then other people get excited around that and aligned around that vision. Right. So I think that's kind of what VCs are looking for, which sounds kind of strange. Like that's not what I think people buy in the public markets. Maybe they do a little bit. Like you still want like a visionary CEO in the public markets, right? Because it's about, you know, future growth. But in the early stage, like you're looking for someone where, again, like you can staff around them those, you know, your VP of marketing, your VP of sales, you know, your eventual like VP of engineering, whatever it is, like you're putting expertise around that person. And that person has to be CEO, like most of the time. But yeah, like sometimes it doesn't work out. You make a bet and that person has to transition to, you know, chairperson or transition to, you know, some other role, or maybe they were more like engineering and product versus like sales, or maybe there were more sales and engineering and product. So I think as a VC, right, like a big role of a VC is like recruiting and hiring, like, right, for their portfolio companies and trying to like figure out, okay, what are the gaps? And they're more looking for, okay, how do I complement out this team? And that is a risk. Like when you're doing, like I mentioned, kind of that inception stage versus like early stage, that's something you're trying to do to de-risk the company. That's why that company also becomes more valuable, because you start with one person who's like this great product visionary. And then at the Series A or the Series B, you have a bunch of other people, right? Like the team is de-risked. The execution of growing the business is de-risked, right? And so that's kind of what you're trying to do. You're trying to do a bunch of things like as an early stage company, but that is like one of the core things you're trying to do is build an organization that de-risks the company, de-risks the business, and helps you grow faster. And like, yeah, I don't think you're looking as an investor to like trade out that initial person. You're hoping they grow into the CEO role, which kind of defers sometimes this management to other great people that you've recruited in and inspired and now manage.
Do you have any stories that you could share or memories of, you know, whether it was you being a part of a company, investing in a company, meeting certain people that really stand out in your life as like, wow, we were a part of that ride. We were instrumental and we get to share in the success to some degree. And then the other aspect of it is, you know, what do you love about this? Do you love the wealth creation aspect? Do you love the entrepreneurial activity, the ability to really enact and implement change in the world with some of these companies to come to life? So what would you say about that?
Yeah, I think I, you know, at my last firm, you know, SAP, you know, large corporate, you know, there's a separate arm that was kind of the venture capital arm. Building a team there was like amazing, right? Like I think the way we thought about it was like you just have to grind in the beginning, right? Until you get to like a certain stage. And then you start to realize and like you're constantly iterating on strategy. And then at some point, you're able to like hire someone that can take over a specific function, whether that's data or whether that's like the investment process I alluded to, or whether that's like fundraising or whether that's value add or something else. So, I mean, I think being patient, maybe I don't know if this answers your question, but like as you're growing the company and trying to work with rock stars, like initially try to align yourself with you know, other rock stars in the beginning, but be willing to do most of the work yourself. And then when you feel like you've created something that is repeatable, then I think you can like hire into that role. But like if you hire too early, you're kind of just wasting cycles because you're probably just doing most of the work yourself anyway. And or like if you have the vision and like it's hard to translate that vision to other people early. So I would build kind of the function and then kind of like bring people in. That's maybe my learning experience on growing teams. Like if you hire too early, like it just doesn't. I think people would take the exact opposite approach. But in my case, like I think if you hire too early, like and they don't fully share your aligned vision, like they just aren't doing anything, right? And it's like you have to build it before you can actually staff it. And then, yeah, why do I do this? Like, I think contributing to the future of humanity, like the innovation economy is very important for everyone's future kind of well-being and probably for like this, you know, savior of the world in many ways. Like that's kind of a crazy, you know, very Silicon Valley centric thought maybe of like, why do people do venture capital? Like, again, in order to make an impact, like you have to think high growth in order to make an impact in your lifetime. Like you have to think of these businesses that scale up in kind of a decade or two. That is the venture model. And how do you support these, in my case, like these financiers of great company ideas, of like impactful company ideas? It's like what Cool Water does is it helps co-build next generation investment firms, like these specialized investors that are financing these solutions that hopefully impact the world, right? And that's a, I think, an important part of our overall economy, our overall world economy. And like, you know, my small role in that is kind of supporting those great investors, trying to tease out who's really good, who's putting real solutions in the world, and then like help those people be successful, right? So I feel like, and we've done it at kind of a meta level where we're not doing it at the company level per se, we're doing it at like the investor level. So like every person that we can help be successful, they potentially could finance 25 to 250 companies in their career, right? And so what we've done over the last couple of years is we've grown into be one of the biggest accelerators in the world through that model, because we've helped a couple hundred funds launch and they've invested now into over 5,000 companies, right? And like, I'm hoping that some of those companies are impactful, right? But it starts at like the who is actually financing these companies. And like, I want to make sure their values are aligned and they're putting like good solutions in the world. And like, that's where I feel motivated to spend my time.
Man, I love that. I never even thought about how many businesses are really started and how many people's lives are impacted because of those companies. So I always say you write a book to change people's lives. I mean, you really can change a lot of people's lives by creating a venture capital fund, right? That's really what it is. You put this together, you help enough businesses make it. And obviously, yes, the LPs make a great hefty return, but just think about what Stripe has done for companies like myself and others that I know. So helping these people get off the ground, God, does wonders for the world. So it's admirable. Yeah. You were mentioning how cool my background is. Now, during this whole interview, I've been looking at the thing directly behind you. It looks unique. It looks special. Can you just tell me what the hell is that thing behind you?
This thing?
Yeah. What is that? It looked like it was some type of document, and I love historical stuff. So I looked at it, I'm like, oh, that has to be something worth a lot of money / historical significance. Anything? What is that?
Yeah, this is a map of the Canadian Rockies in British Columbia. And so it's an original map, I believe, designed by Swiss people that crossed Canada and kind of mapped out Canada and kind of built in large part the Railroad of Canada. But they, there's this woman who lives in a small town near Inverness. And so she collects these maps and then builds, actually, it's a three-dimensional art piece that you can't tell on video.
I can see a little bit now,
but
I can
it's
see.
Like there's like the glass is kind of like an inch out, and it's like, yeah, the it's an a species that's kind of native to the area, and then it's like, yeah, it's this three-dimensional art piece kind of built out. It's kind of like a funky design, but it's built on one of these like original maps.
So. What year was that map created then?
I don't know. I should look, but it's probably like early 1900s maybe.
Oh, okay, very cool. Yeah, it looks like you're into the whether it's the Native American or just you love history, and I love true stories and I love history. So got good taste. I mean, you still don't have a book spinner, but you're okay still.
I know. Yeah, what everyone didn't see is I set up this little thing before we launched live.
It works. And that's your company right there, right? That logo?
Yeah. This is Coolwater Capital.
And yeah, so the website, do you have a couple different websites, or which is the one that you want to recommend to anybody who's looking to get into this or to just find out more about you or your company?
Yeah, coolwatercap.com is the website. You can check us out on LinkedIn, reach out to me on LinkedIn. We also have websites for the books, how to raise a venture capital fund.com, and my second book, how to set up a venture capital fund.com. A little bit long as a URL, but pretty straightforward as a book title.
Yeah, if you Google it, it's going to pop right up. So it's smart by doing it. But anyways, guys, check out his book. Obviously, a wealth of knowledge. We could talk for hours about this. And, try to keep it simple. So how to raise a venture capital fund, the essential guide on fundraising and understanding limited partners. And obviously has been around, knows some stuff that I know nothing about. Very interesting. So Winter Mead, thanks so much for being here, man. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Congrats on your book and congrats on your business as well.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, entrepreneurship. We got to preach the message, man. That's what changes the world. In my opinion, it's not politics, it's entrepreneurs. So remember, guys, $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.